Almost sounds like I got a failure in my microphone. The TechNet meets most Sunday evenings at this time. We've recently made a change where we run the TechNet for 3 hours instead of 4 hours. These guys who run it need their beauty sleep. As you've heard so often, the main purpose of the TechNet is to transfer information, education. And so we do that in three separate sections. The first section, people sign in because they do have a question or a comment for the net, and we take those in order. They sign in by giving me their call letters, their name, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment. You need that sign in just because you're listening. After all these years, we believe somebody is listening. The second section is run roughly an hour later, nothing exact about that, by Dr. Roy, AC2GS, who runs the science talk and mailbag. And the third section is run by Paul, WS2N, who tells us the latest of what's going on with each of the space agencies and what launches are taking place and what NASA is doing. When we get to Roy tonight, he's got an interesting set of puzzles, as I do. Somebody mailed me a puzzle some time ago, which if we don't get a whole bunch of sign-ins, I'll give you this, let me think, it looks like it's a 10-part or 11-part puzzle on the subject of standing wave ratio in general. It's a true-false set of questions where the answers are quite different sometimes than common sense. Okay, let's see if we got anybody to sign in tonight. If you do have a question or comment for the net, please give me a call, letters and name, with the word yes right now. Kate.
Roger. This is KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey. Yes, and name here is Joe in the mobile.
WB2GXM, Rich, and yes.
KD2OQO, Mike, and no.
Alpha Charlie 2, India Sierra, Bill, yes. Okay, so that time we got Joe, Rich, OQO, just checking in, and Bill, AC2IS. Anyone else? Give me a call letters right now and name. K2IS, I'll be listening. There may have been a station there, but it was 98% noise and 2% audio, and the audio was not copyable, I'm sorry to say. One last call. Anyone to join the question and answer and comment section of the TechNet? Give me a call letters and name right now. Yeah, that very noisy station made a second attempt. Make one last attempt. I'll listen on the input and see if I can hear you. Let's see, was anyone else besides me able or not able to copy that last station? Give me a call letters if you were able to copy.
Sounds like RYY.
Okay, I wasn't hearing that well. Joe, I hope there's a way that you can make some kind of a change because your signal is 98% noise right now. If it's RYY, change the method by which you're doing it, Joe. The B2RYY question mark, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Roger. Name here is Joe in the mobile. KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey.
Okay, Queen Yankee Whiskey, you're right ahead with your question or comment. My name is Dick.
Hey, love you guys. I haven't been out here in a long, long, long time. I've been sleeping real early. My question is Monday a federal holiday? My question is there going to be mail delivery? That's my question. Back to you, Dick.
I don't know, and I'm going to throw it open to the net. I think there's a medium good chance it's a federal holiday and no mail, but let's see if anyone has further information. So, do you believe tomorrow?
K2AMZ, Mike. I'm a federal employee, and yes, it's a federal holiday.
Thank you, Mike.
Mike?
Yes. Again, it is a federal holiday. I get the day off, and I'm 98% sure that the post offices will also be closed. But every federal office should be closed tomorrow.
Looks like you got your question, Joe. Let's see if Joe's got any follow-up on that. Mr. QIW, K2RIW.
Okay, yeah, thank you very much. Roger, roger, roger. Yeah, because I'm going to order a new home-based fleet scanner. Probably the unit in, I think it's the 999-265 or something like that. I don't remember the numbers, but all right. So thank you for all the good information, and I have the whole week off. I have the whole week off, so I'll come back on next week Sunday to listen to you guys. And yeah, I'll be out here for the next 3 hours. And back to you, Dick.
And if anything that we say stirs up another question in your mind, Joe, come right back and shine it again and give us that question. Next person on the list was Rich, WB2GXM. Go right ahead, Rich, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, WB2GXM. Thank you, Dick. I have a question about, I'm installing a custom AGC board into a MicroPIDX transceiver, and it calls for me to remove some of the green coating from a PC board in order to expose the traces. Do you know of any chemical that I could use, maybe with a small Q-tip, to remove this green covering without damaging the trace?
Yeah, that green covering has a very specific name. I think it's fungus proofing or something like that. And let's see, of the guys who are listening, do you know of chemistry that will remove the green coating from a PC board so that poor Rich doesn't have to go through the process of scraping it away? I have, where I wanted to solder a small section of that trace that was underneath the green coating, scraped it away with a razor blade, X-Acto knife, and whatever. So scraping is not too difficult. Got to be a little bit careful you don't scrape so hard you go through the copper. So if at worst you don't find chemistry, scraping does work. I've done it. And to my knowledge, the places where I did it lasted for years. Let's see if anyone out there knows of a chemical that with a Q-tip will remove the green coating in the specific area that Mike wants to work on, that Rich wants to work on. Give me a call. That is a name right now. K2IW in the TechNet.
KD2AMZ, I'm back again. I used to work at PhotoCircuits, which is now defunct. That is a photo resist used for flow soldering. Really is no way to remove it. You gotta take it off with a very fine, like an X-Acto knife. It's not hard to do.
Yeah, we used to call it a humor seal.
That sounds right, humor seal. Fungus proofing. Got lots of fancy names like that. So, according to Mike AMZ, that may not be chemistry that removes it. Now, hold on now, Mike. If it's a photoresist, you do remove it in certain areas when you're doing the photoresist process. There's got to be a way of duplicating that photoresist process. KD2AMZ, K2RIW.
What the UV does is it cures the product. The other way around, the uncured is just removable. We used to use methylene chloride, not a healthy chemical to use these days, but that removes the uncured photoresist. And when we used to have to examine the printed circuit boards, I was, again, PhotoCircuits, Glen Cove, PhotoCircuits manufacturer. I used to actually work in the lab to make sure the quality was good. We had to remove it. The cured photo resist, the green stuff, and it's used for flow soldering because, remember, those rigs, I forgot the name of it, I'm having a senior moment, they're flow soldered. And again, you can just scrape it off with a nice, fine X-Acto knife, and it's really not that hard to do.
Comment.
Go ahead, Dick, with comment.
When the photoresist is exposed to ultraviolet light, the material hardens and becomes water resistant. clear areas in the image allow ultraviolet light to pass through the, so clear areas will harden when exposed to ultraviolet light. So I'm a little bit confused with the explanation, because it is not uncured, it is, maybe I did not understand it properly. So it will not wash anyway during development if it's hardened with UV.
You are correct. You said when it is exposed to UV, UV hardens it. Unexposed is removable.
So all of the green stuff that's on that board has intentionally been exposed in order to harden it. Is that true, Mike?
Exactly. It is UV cured, which forms a very hard surface, which is the, you know, solder won't stick to it. And the whole point of it, it is resistant to solvents because we used to wash them in methylene chloride, a very good solvent, highly carcinogenic, but that's the whole point. You got to scrape it away.
But didn't it look like we got a fairly solid answer on that one, Rich? So I've done it by scraping. Sounds to me like Mike has done it by scraping. Probably other people have. So a careful scraping job will do it. After you finish it and it's successful, come back and let us know, even if it's unsuccessful. You're trying to make contact to one of the traces in order to, what, add a wire or to fix a crack in the trace. What are you actually doing there, Rich? WB2GXM, K2RIW.
Well, Dick, the MicroBidX I sold is a Tinkerer's Delight. It's a really beautifully crafted little project that'll take years, kind of like all sorts of other projects you love to work on. It does not include an AGC. So there are many third-party AGC boards being made for this open source project. And I bought one and I'm going to be putting it in. It requires cutting a trace in one spot and exposing the three other spots on the board to tack solder the AGC border board into. I will scrape it and I will take my time. Thanks for all the information.
Assuming that the trace is not super long, you could also go to the end of the trace where it actually comes out with a component or whatever, which might be more accessible with a skinny wire running up there if you don't want to do scraping. That's on the assumption now that this AGC circuit and all the wiring to it is not RF sensitive, where the length of wire would be critical. And laying it parallel to the trace above the green until you come to the end of the trace where it's connected to a component would be a way of keeping it from picking up stray signals. So you got multiple ways of doing it. In my, if I was you, I would do the scraping. But just letting you know that there is another way of going about it. Back to you, Rich, WB2GXM, K2RIW.
I concur, Dick. These specific instructions about tack soldering are there to avoid failure of the circuit due to RF pickup inside the radio, because it is affecting the RF gain and not the AF gain. It is an RF circuit.
RF automatic gain control. Probably working on the eventually passing feedback to some of the earlier stages that have a gain-adjustable gate, so to speak. Is that approximately what's going on here, Rich?
As I understand the circuit, audio feedback is being used to control the RF in an earlier stage to regulate the RF gain. So AF later controls RF earlier.
A very noisy signal. Want to give it another try?
KC1SAM. Dick, can you hear what's coming out of Selden? It's very, very noisy.
Okay, I'm going to flip over to Selden. You're absolutely right. Selden is extremely noisy. Let's see if Lou is available to maybe make an improvement. NY2H, K2RIW, are you available, Lou?
This is NY2H. Let me listen
to myself
and see what's going on.
Yeah, I just flipped over to Selden, and I'm doing you just made an improvement. Did you just fix it, Lou? NY2H, K2RIW?
I did not do a thing. You know, we have a F-duplex link, so if there was a carrier on Selden or something, that would have knocked you out. So, I don't know, I'll turn. I got a dual receiver here now, so I'll turn over. But I'm glad it's good. Let's say it that way.
No audio coming out of Selden right now.
I'm hearing audio coming out of Selden, Sam. My voice is coming out of Selden right now. Over to you, Sam.
I got it. It was off,
Now, your signal is a bit noisy. Alrighty. The circuit got scared. It knew that Lou was on the way there and decided to start working again. And right now, Selden sounds good from my signal. Alrighty. Looks like... Now, is the audio being rectified to make a DC voltage that then can control the gain of the RF circuit? Is that how the HEC is working? In other words, it's the integrated envelopes of the audio that's being probably rectified and summed as a DC voltage that does the automatic gain control. There is a kind of gain control that's done, that's called, envelope following. A very fast kind of AGC that allows you to do a repeater function. That my guess is that you're not doing that. WV2GXM, K2RIW.
I believe that's the way it's working, Dick. I have not received the circuit yet, and there is no schematic in the materials I have yet. I just have a general idea of how this thing works, but I've got good reviews for it.
Okay, let us know how that works out after you do the scraping and soldering. Bill, AC2, IS, K2RIW, go ahead, Bill.
Yes, this is AC2IS, and I have a question that has to do with home heating. I've got a high-efficiency boiler. It's about 11 years old. It's got connected to it, they call it an indirect water heater with a stainless steel tank. And so my question has to do with galvanic action between steel parts, stainless steel parts, and copper. I've got more to this question, but I'm going to let it go back to you in case you have a clarifying question, AC2IS.
I've been told that you can buy a set of unions, or whatever they're called, couplings, which have a ceramic insert between the input connector and the output connector. You can set these up on a hot water heater, a tank, for instance, and various other things. It is my belief that an awful lot of the galvanic action that eats up the sacrificial rod inside of a hot water heater is caused by dissimilar metals in direct contact. That copper pipe that comes from your domestic water pipes that are in your house and goes into the hot water heater. It's large in diameter, thick in copper, and probably has milliohms or microohms of resistance, so it's all set up to do some very low voltage galvanic action. So when you put in a isolating device, like I did it with, not the right way to do it, but I did it with PVC couplings, I think they're called PVC, that galvanic action essentially stopped, even though you would think I'm still grounding it by way of the BX cable that that feeds power to the motor. And I think I remember putting rubber washers between the actual oil-burning device and the rest of the tank. I think I put rubber washers in there to isolate that. But there's great advantage in doing that, and only a small percentage of the hot water heater tanks are electrically isolated, and I think they should be. But that's an opinion. Not everyone's going to agree with it, I believe. AC2IS, K2RIW, go ahead, Bill.
Yes, Dick, that's, I think that I would have benefited from that quite a bit, but I don't see how it is that rubber would be appropriate here because of the valve. That would lead to a failure. But no, you said something about ceramics, and I wonder if ceramics would hold up due to like the ding and cooling of the pipes that might cause them to expand and contract, and maybe that would cause ceramic to crack. But yeah, electrical isolation would be great. So I had a situation with a stainless steel tank, and stainless steel tanks, this tank had a lifetime warranty on it, and these stainless steel tanks do not have sacrificial rods because they're stainless steel. They're not supposed to degrade. Unfortunately, I believe it was a plumber, a heating company that, they're happy to sell you a high-end product, but okay, the thing is supposed to last at least 30 years, but they put fittings in there that are quote-unquote 9-year or 11-year parts. So the seal fittings get destroyed. I'm going to let it drop for a moment and then ask my final question.
WS2I.
We're going to pick you up after he finishes the question, Paul, so stand by. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, so my question is about galvanic action. I understand, I don't understand everything, I don't understand all the numbers here, but I understand that if there's a large steel part mated to a large copper part, there's a certain amount of galvanic action that's going to take place. In the case of plumbing, it's all filled with water, so that's going to accelerate things a bit. Especially this is heated water, so the temperature involved is going to accelerate things a bit. But I believe that the feeling in general is that, steel and copper used in combination do not create excessive, galvanic action. Most boilers have sacrificial rods, so they would get replaced and the galvanic action would be going on there instead of in the tank itself. But in this case, there's no sacrificial rod because the tank is supposedly immune to this. But there's a large amount of steel. A small amount of it is not stainless. Have I not now sort of concentrated all that galvanic action from the large volume of steel down to this small part that's not stainless? Am I not corroding that at a much accelerated rate because that's the only non-stainless steel part in the equation? That's my question, AC2IS.
I see your concern, Bill, and I have the same concern. And by the way, there is a list you can look up of dissimilar metals, and the list will show you each of the metals with some kind of a number alongside of it, positive or negative, depending on which polarity it acts like. And when you put dissimilar metals together with an electrolyte between them, they act like a battery, and current flows. And there's always minerals contained in water. If the water was absolutely perfect, distilled water, that's a pretty good insulator, but nobody has water like that. I guarantee, though, that Paul WS2N has got a lot more to say about this. So, and by the way, I believe that this ceramic coupling, I'm calling it ceramic, ceramic-like coupling that you can buy at a good plumbing house, is made to tolerate the temperature difference on a hot water heater. I think it's specifically designed to isolate a hot water heater. Paul maybe has more information on that. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
This is WS2N. Yes, they have dielectric unions, probably anywhere, usually around $10 or so, for like a 3/4 or a 1-inch. You can put it right onto your tank, onto the hot water tank. But they use them in hot water heating systems too. Some cases you want to keep the elements isolated, and that's one way to do it. So yeah, you have it's really like two gaskets. One gasket separate it, and then there's a plastic collar that goes over the other side. So the actual one side is not touching the other side.
So this way you could have, you know, galvanized on one side, copper on the other, and water's the electrolyte. And no matter what you do, you're not going to get that battery action because it's completely isolated, insulated from one another with the collar system. Or, you know, one's like a collar and the other one's like a gasket. Back to you, Dan.
So we call that a dielectric union? Is that the part you ask for? Let's see now. My house is an old-fashioned house that has, I think it's half-inch diameter water pipes in some places, not all of them, a three-quarter. Let's hope that thing comes in that diameter also. So, dielectric union, I think is what you called it. And I presume you, in order to install it, you actually cut the pipe and solder it into this union. Is that the way it's done, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, whatever type you have, you might have copper on one side, you might have maybe steel on the other side, so you would get one that, you know, with a thread on one side to attach that steel, and then you might be going to copper, whatever your situation is. And they have different size ones. I do a lot of larger ones, you know, for heating systems, maybe 2-inch or 1.5-inch, you know, larger ones. And then the most domestic, you know, house heaters are probably all, you know, 3/4, maybe 1-inch. You could isolate it, the whole thing. You can isolate your boiler. And, you know, you could go up to high temperatures that could be attached to your boiler. Designed for that. But, yeah, if you were to go to a plumbing supply house, you would ask for a dielectric union. And they'll say, what kind? Well, mine's screw by screw or, you know, copper by copper. And, you know, they'll give you whatever one you have. Back to you, Dick.
Now, part of what Bill was telling us, his wording led us to believe that because some of the steel is called stainless steel, he'd like to believe that the stainless steel is not a dissimilar metal to copper and that it cannot be corroded. I'm a little worried about that one. Yes, the portion that's not stainless sounds like it's going to be attacked a lot faster, but is stainless steel and copper, when brought into direct electrical contact metallically with fluid flowing between them, that's a slightly mineral containing, I think some galvanic action could still take place. You got an opinion on that one, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
I think any metals that are different will cause some kind of galvanic action. So, you know, I think that might be more durable. There's different ways of, like, you know, before they had the dielectric unions, and they still do now, you could take a brass nipple in between whatever unit you're talking about, and they consider that brass almost being like a dielectric, but, you know, it's not 100%. Brass is pretty good, you know, you might be coming in with a, you know, copper on one end and steel on the other, you put a brass nipple in between. And that's usually pretty good. Sometimes even, you know, a brass valve, you know, is really good enough. It's pretty hard to get past that. It's, you know, when you really have that steel-copper connection that you really tend to get the electrolysis you're trying to avoid, then I would go with dielectric union. Pretty good. You know, you got to be careful, you know, when you install them because you have to slide the collar, you know, and make sure the collar's away from the heat. If you're going to solder something on, you know, you don't want to destroy your $10 union, your $10 coupling correction union. By the way, they make some kind of unions, regular couplings. They'll have, like, plastic on the inside, plastic thread on the inside. I want to trust them, but they make them, too.
Hey, can I ask a query?
Go ahead, Bill.
I was not asserting that the stainless steel would not count as dissimilar metal, quite the opposite. My concern is that there's a large amount of copper piping throughout the house. There's a large volume of steel, if you include the fitting that's connected to the water tank and the water tank itself. It's just when you consider those two parts together, the fitting and the tank, I believe that
goes into a sort of a calculation where you figure out, okay, there's a hunk of steel of this size connected to a hunk of copper of this size. And, you know, there's this, I guess, you know, water is an electrolyte in this scenario. So, okay, they're water electrolyte. So then you run numbers and you figure out, okay, how much corrosion do we think is going to happen? I think they call it the more noble or the less ever. In this case, it's the steel that would be corroded, copper. Then, since only a small part of the steel is not stainless, am I not concentrating all of the corrosion for that entire, you know, volume of steel? When you run those numbers, you come up with some amount of corrosion that's going to take place. Am I not now concentrating it all down onto the small part, the fitting? Is that not corroding a lot faster than it otherwise would have if, say, the entire tank, entire water tank, was ordinary steel as opposed to that, is my question. Then I guess I have another question about relative cost of features like the dielectric and how the plumber might have done me a disservice at installation time and now second time around on the repair, AC2IS.
Yeah, I see your concern, Bill, and I think I agree. I would be equally concerned. But something is bothering me on what Paul said. A brass fitting is a pretty massive object. It's got a pretty thick chunk of brass. Brass is highly conductive. So copper to brass, you got a good contact. And brass to steel, you got a good contact. And so you got a little bit of resistance in that brass so that the steel and the copper are not directly connected to each other, but they're connected through milliohms of brass. And so with water flowing through there, well, that's got mineral matter in it, I think you're still going to get galvanic action. Before I did this dielectric isolation of my hot water pipe, a hot water heater, the nearby copper pipes, my hot water heater, used to develop pinholes. Couldn't figure out why pinholes were so developing so often. I would fix each of the pinholes, and a month later there would be more of them. So there was galvanic action taking place where the copper pipe, in my case, was the sacrificial element. The hot water heater of that particular brand name was connected, and I'm presuming the inside was steel with glass lining. Quite a few of these hot water heaters have got a glass-lined tank, and you're supposed to believe the water is only going to touch glass. Well, that can't possibly be. You've got fittings screwed into it. Somewhere the glass ends, the fitting begins, and the water is in contact with metal, as I see it. Increase the amount of metallic contact with the water with glass lining, but it doesn't solve it. And with the temperature cycling, how much longevity do you get with that glass lining? Do all of them have glass lining? Or was it just the particular one that I was using that claimed to be glass lined? You see, I've got quite a few questions. I'd like to believe we got some people on frequency who've got a lot more plumbing smarts than either Bill and I or Paul. If so, please give us your call letters and tell us what's really going on here as far as the code and the real physics of this particular dissimilar metal situation. And by the way, when you do look at that list of dissimilar metals, the further apart on that list your two things coming in contact are, the more galvanic action you're going to get. I guarantee steel and bronze and copper on that list have a fair amount of spacing so that there is going to be galvanic action, is my guess. K2IW listening for anyone else who wants to give us further information. I was hoping we have some plumbing experts on frequency. Maybe not. I wouldn't trust the brass. If you can buy a dielectric insulator, which really is a real insulating material, plastic, ceramic, whatever, which is made to tolerate the temperatures of a hot water heater, I would trust that to do the isolating. And that's not a big installation, although maybe you don't want to do it yourself. Maybe you want to have the your plumber do it for you. And how much of the other hardware connected to the hot water heater has to be made in a floating manner in order to stop the galvanic action is another interesting question. AC2IS, K2RIW, go ahead, Bill. I know we didn't give you great answers yet.
This is AC2IS. I'm going ahead with the next part tending to sort of, anonymize or randomize the dollar figures here. I don't get too specific on that. But let's say, you know, there's a high-end water heater. It's a just a tank, a heat exchanger. They call it a direct water heater, connect furnace. But, you know, it's made of stainless, so it's more expensive than most. You know, the company is more than happy to sell you the more component. But then they're connecting it up when they do their, but they're connecting it up with the normal cheap parts that do not come up to the grade of the tank, it seems like. Anyway, expensive tank that I paid and a number of dollars for, and yet the labor involved to hook this up is N times 2, or maybe more than that. So, okay, they did what I consider to be a poor design and or installation job up front, such that the fittings that they used got destroyed and took the tank with it, the higher-end tank. I still don't know if I'm going to get my warranty honored on the tank that died, but I've got another one in the same type. And unfortunately, it's been installed by the same people in the same way. So at this point, okay, let's say this dielectric union is a $10 part, very cheap in the grand scheme of things, but installing it, is that not going to cost me N times 2 anyway? Because, I mean, what guys did was sort of connect up a new set of pipes and charge the full money for it, it seems like. I don't know at this point. Do I let this whole thing go for another 11 years and have it, you know, self-destruct on me in the same way and then try to address the issue? Or should I hire somebody to undo what was the installation job that was done just done and have it redone right? AYS.
I'm hoping there's a plumber somewhere you can find who will just disconnect the dissimilar metal connection now and install that dielectric union for you. I guess there's two of them, one going in and one coming back out. And this auxiliary water tank, I presume there's a coil in the main boiler of your hot water system that circulates water into the auxiliary tank that becomes your storage for hot water for domestic use. Is that the way it works, Bill? AC2IS? K2RIW?
Yes, Dick. So there's a furnace, there's two pipes coming out of the furnace to go to the indirect water heater. There's a circulator pump to push that water into the indirect quote-unquote heater, which is really just a heater. The coil of pipe inside the indirect heater. That comes out and goes back to the furnace. One of the problems on the initial installation was they had a cutoff valve on the return, but not a cutoff valve on the side with the circulator pump. So when this failure happened, there was a pinhole leak. The fitting itself looked like it was just rotting away with rust. Afraid to touch it for fear that it might collapse. But the pinhole leak did seem to be sort of right at the interface between this coupling and the tank. And so there was unfortunately no way to flip all the cutoff valves and have there be no water pressure going to the tank. Because there was still water pressure getting to the tank through the pipe with the circulator pump in it, which I think was another design flaw in the initial installation. That part they did correct on the reinstall, so they're now two cutoff valves. I think that completely describes the exchange situation. Let me know if I did not explain that completely. AYS.
Hey, you did give us a pretty good explanation there, Bill. The coil that goes into the boiler, I think, is another source of failure that people have had that particular coil fail. I believe that's a replaceable part. You have reason to believe that coil into the boiler room is in shape And I think you're saying this whole installation is only 11 years old when you got the failure. Over to you, Paul. I mean, Bill, KTRIW.
So this coil, the heat exchange coil, is inside the tank. It's part of the tank. It's not replaceable. There's no way to open up this tank. There is sort of it's sitting inside of a plastic liner that's in turn filled with, I think, foam insulation. And I can take, there's a plastic cap on top. I can take the plastic cap off and I can just see some place where the expanding foam did not quite close in the entire top. Similar cap on the bottom. And that's it. There's no way to get inside this thing. You know, better than 90% sure that that is a stainless steel coil inside the stainless steel tank. The problem is, okay, there's a steel fitting that goes to that, you know, the side of that tank, two steel fittings. Those essentially connect directly to that coil that's inside the tank. Yeah, no way to open the tank, no way to get that internal coil out of the tank. Again, the tank just being a pretty simple heat exchanger.
Yeah, Bill, I was not talking about the coil that's inside of your tank. The water from the boiler. The boiler has to heat water that's circulating through it. There's a coil in the boiler, which I believe in some cases becomes corroded. And it is, and it becomes partially clogged, and the flow through it decreases. And on well-made boilers, that is a replaceable part. So there's a kind of heat exchanger. The heated water in the boiler is in contact with a coil that has water passing through it. That's water being circulated between the boiler and your external tank. So that's the coil that I was worried about, that some people have had a failure in that one, Bill. As I said, in many cases, that's a replaceable part. AC2IS, K2RIW.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, the internal coil fell on me a couple of years ago. I think I mentioned it a couple of weeks ago. It's like a $900 repair job. No, they cut the lines. They have to physically unbolt that coil, put it in a new coil, and connect the lines again. But, you know, that's a costly repair job. But, you know, if you get 15, 20 years out of it like I did, that's good. Now, he's got, they used to call it, I think it was a store tank. You know, so the reason for his is just, you know, without the store tank, you know, people don't get immediate hot water when they turn on the hot water. That's one problem. But if you're just using the internal coil without his tank, and also you don't have the volume, you know, you take a couple of showers, and next thing you know, you're going to get cold water. Your boiler can't heat up that water fast enough as it's going through that half-inch coils inside your hot water heater. So, you know, he's got that store tank. That keeps a whole big tank hot. It's got its own aquastat on it and everything, and it keeps that whole tank. So now he's got like maybe a 30-gallon tank that's filled with hot water all the time. So that's the advantage of having that. But I would definitely put four unions on that. So, you're going to have to do that. Separate the two going in, you know, from the boiler and the water in and water out that's going into your domestic hot water. Back to you, Dave.
To install these dielectric unions, a naive person like me thinks that you cut the pipe, make sure you get the right kind of fittings, and put it together. Each one of those unions, it sounds to me like a 10-15 minutes worth of labor. So all four of them, done by a reasonable plumber, shouldn't be a huge price. You just said that to replace the coil inside the boiler was $900. Is the part very expensive? Is the time required to replace it very timely? What makes the price as high as $900, Paul? That seems a little high. And maybe you shopped around and found out that's the best price you're going to get. WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, I mean, my coil, I think, was going back a couple of years, roughly around 500, a little over 500. So, you know, they're going to charge you a couple hundred or more. Mine was a difficult situation. One of the studs was broken. They had to do a whole new stud thing on it. It's, you know, it depends on the job. But my guess is for a domestic system, it's probably going to cost you about that. Back to you there.
Okay, we got to get used to those prices. Looks like we've only got partial information for what you're looking for, Bill, but we've made a little bit of progress. I do think it's worthwhile to add 4 dielectric couplings. And if it's a little bit expensive, but I think it's going to greatly increase the life of your system to stop the galvanic action between those 4 fittings.
Go with union, dielectric union, Dick.
Dielectric union. What did I call it by mistake, Paul?
You call them dielectric couplings. You can get them. They look like regular couplings, steel couplings sometimes. And, you know, but on the inside, it's this plastic thread, and I just don't trust them. So in other words, you're screwing one to the other. You're choosing screw connections, not really sided connections. I found they leak. But the other ones are good, and they do take a little bit of time, because the guy who's installing it has to keep the, there's a collar that slides back, you know, that you don't want it near the torch when you're heating the part of the union to the pipe, and then that slides forward, you know, kind of like an exotic PL-259 installation or something. You know, you got to think ahead before you do it, you know, if you're going to do it yourself. You don't want to foul up. And then you got the regular rubber gasket in between the two, and then you just tighten the union to one side to the other, and then pull the two together, and that's it. On big commercial jobs, they actually have big, you know, flanges, and the bolts and everything are insulated from one another, and they go through a whole process. You know, you can go up to 2-3-4-inch connections, you know. But for a house, they look like regular unions, except they've got this, you know, one collar usually you can tell is red, and the one on the inside is black. Back to you there.
Oh, dielectric union, not dielectric coupling. And so I made the mistake of thinking those are similar words. Obviously, they got very specific meanings in the plumbing world. Okay, keep us informed as you progress with this situation, Bill. And I'm with you. 11 years strikes me as too short a number if the installation was done correctly. And hopefully there's a plumber somewhere that will install those unions for you without a huge expense. Maybe not the same guy who installed it the first time. EC2IS, K2RIW.
Dick, a quick piece of information about the differences between the unions and coupling.
Go right ahead, Paul.
When you install any kind of a coupling, you know, you can't take it apart. You know, one end might be sweated on, the other end might be sweated on. One might be a screw part, the other end might be sweat. Both might be screw, but make a long story short, you can't take it apart. That's for the couplings, but with all unions, whether it's a dielectric one or not, you can take them apart. You know, one end is connected to one pipe, one end is connected to the other pipe, and then you've got this collar that screws, you know, that connects the two. You tighten them together, and there's always, you know, like in a lot of cases, you know, the seat is just perfect where when you tighten it up, it's like metal against metal, and it doesn't leak. But you can take them apart again. You know, if you had to work on something, you could physically take them apart, which is, you know, really makes them neat.
If there's a threaded object in the middle that allows you to take them apart, where is the insulation, Paul? I'm having a little trouble picturing where the insulation that gives you the dielectric function. Go ahead.
Yeah, on a regular union, of course, you don't have the insulation system. It's you know, metal on metal. That's your standard union, but the dielectric one has a gasket in between where the two faces come together. On a regular system, you would just have metal against metal. On the dielectrics, you have a black gasket that goes in between. And when you tighten it together, you know, that's what you're pushing against. That's why it doesn't leak on that. And yet it's insulated. But the outside collar has this plastic dielectric collar that's separating the collar from the pipe itself that it's attached to. So, you know, that's why there's two things involved in that. It's hard to describe. I guess if you brought it up, it's easy to, if you bring up dielectric union on the internet, you'll see the difference on an exploded view, what they look like, little different parts. It would be like five parts involved, you know, in and out, and then you've got the collar itself that tightens up, and then you've got the two gasket things that are involved. Back to you, Dick.
So the real insulation, then, is the gasket-like thing. It's not ceramic. It sounds to me like it's rubber or plastic or whatever, but still it's insulating material. You're getting a little bit of a fried egg on your last two transmissions, Paul. When my rig does that, I tap my fist on the rig, and the instability of the phase lock loop goes away and it stops doing that. So you're getting a little bit of a fried egg. It's only 10% noise, but you're getting that on your last two transmissions, WS2N, K2IW.
I know, I've had it for years. And this is my older radio, the ICOM, and it keeps creeping up, starting to go again. And then I got fed up with that, and I bought another Yaesu. I toasted that one in a couple of years. I think my power supply went into overdrive and blew that radio. So now I went back to my old radio again. I think it's time for another one. Back to you, Dick.
Okay. Are you able to hear what's actually coming out so that you know when the fried egg is there, Paul?
Yeah, QSL. Very annoying. Sometimes if I change the power level, it'll work better. You know, if I lower the volume, sometimes it'll go away.
Do one of those experiments right now. Go up and down on the power. Do whatever you do. Hit it with your fist. Let's see if you can get the fried egg to go away.
C2IS info.
Go ahead, sir.
Not working. I think it's just getting worse. I heard somebody with info. Back to you, sir.
You got it, Bill.
I just dug out the insulation manual for the boiler. And does not seem to have this coil as you describe it. It's got a part exchanger assembly. The igniter and burner actually sit inside of it. I don't see anything that would indicate what this is of, or how expensive the part would be, or what it would cost to have it replaced. But it looks sort of like a tube, I guess, that gives you a water jacket around the burner assembly. For some reason, it looks like there's two, and the burner assembly sits inside one of them, and the other tube has anything to occupy it, but maybe there is, and it's just not shown in the diagram. AC2IS.
The burner is trying to heat up the water that's in the boiler. Isn't that its main function? And the hot water heat exchanger is a secondary function. Maybe I'm wrong on that one, Bill. Go ahead.
Comment.
Go ahead, comment, and identify yourself, sir.
It's Ed, K2GJE. It's usually a black plate with about 6 volts, and it has the in and the output fittings of water. Over.
And that replaceable assembly, any idea, Ed, how expensive that is and how difficult that is to change? If it does become corroded, and I think that's one of its failure modes.
I had it done about 3-5 years ago, and it was also about a $500-$600 job. I was getting electrolysis from the in and out pipes going to the steel plate. Also, you have more than just steel there. Stainless is nickel and different amounts of chromium. You have a big mix of metals, over.
So you're saying that even though it may be called stainless, that doesn't mean it's immune to corrosion. That's what I think you're saying, Ed. Go ahead.
Exactly. You have a big mix of metals here. You have steel, you have chrome, you have nickel, and then you have your copper pipes. I'd definitely go for those dielectric unions, over.
And the plate itself of this heat exchanger that goes into the boiler sounds to me like it's screwed down to the maybe the cast iron of the boiler, and maybe an insulating gasket is required there to stop galvanic action. What do you think, Ed?
K2GJE, there is a gasket. There's a lot of heat there. It's more like a fiber material, and the plumber just put some pipe joint compound on both sides of it when he put the heat exchanger coil back, and then he bolted down the 6 bolts. And he seems to have had a lot of experience with this. What he did was wrap on all the bolts before attempting to turn them, and he was very lucky. None of them broke, over.
And those bolts, is there a way of putting the right kind of washers and tubings and whatever, insulating materials on those bolts, so that now the bolts are not forcing a electrical contact between the boiler and the replaceable assembly? Is it possible to float that replaceable assembly in there? Over to you, Ed. Electrically floated.
No, Dick, I don't think so. They're like 5/16, 18 volts. They're going into the cast iron boiler on one side, and they're going through the plate on the other side. Well, the plate just has through holes, and then they don't have any lock washers. They're just torqued up. And the bolts weren't any problem. I was getting galvanic action where the fittings are going from half-inch thread to half-inch copper. Over the years, always showed some electrolysis, but I never paid any attention to it. My problem was the steel plate failed, over.
Do you think a dielectric union on each of those interconnections where the copper pipe went into that assembly would have made an improvement? What do you think, Ed?
Probably no harm, but at the meantime, I'll just keep my eyes on it. I had a lot of plumbing changed at that time. I had a tempering valve replaced. I had a lot of extra valves rather than of the screw type, of the ball type, installed, so I can really isolate something. And the way it's set up, I can reverse flow the water in that coil. I used to do it years ago when I had some flow problems, and that helped, over.
Gotcha. Okay, over to you, Bill, for any final comments, because we've used up our time for this section of the TechNet. AC2IS, K2IW.
Well, this is AC2IS, and I'm trying to take a look at this heat exchanger assembly. If I'm looking at things right at the moment, it seems to be very large compared to the overall size of the burner. This is a quote-unquote high-efficiency gas-fired burner. I mean, its purpose is to heat water. It's not doing any, air heating. The house is baseboard heat. So one purpose in life is to heat water. It kind of makes sense to me that this heat assembly, supposedly the exhaust coming out of this is supposed to be below the dew point, so there's all kinds of additional stuff in there to sort of extract water from the exhaust, so that does not become a problem. Yeah, this heat exchange assembly seems to be like a physically large thing, probably a big deal to replace. Again, I don't know what the materials are. AC2IS.
Okay, thank you for that explanation, Bill. Going over to Roy now, AC2GS, with the space talk and mailbag, if there is any. He's got a puzzle. I didn't get a chance for my puzzle tonight.